From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, suspected of planning a Walmart mass shooting, a Kerrville man is arrested. Now we find out more about his Nazi views shared online. QAnon held a convention in Dallas, and Texas elected officials showed up. And with GOP efforts to restrict voting in Texas, more than 100 scholars of democracy say American democracy is in grave danger.
But if you look at how democracies end, very often they go out not with a bang, but with a whimper.
This is Texas Matters. From Texas Public Radio, I'm David Martin Davies. State and federal law enforcement arrested 28-year-old Coleman Thomas Blevins last Friday, accusing him of preparing to launch a mass shooting at a Walmart. According to the Kerr County Sheriff's Office, a search of Blevins' Kerrville apartment turned up firearms, ammunition, and material officials described as radical ideology paraphernalia. Investigators said they intercepted a message online from Blevins that indicated that he was preparing to proceed with a mass shooting. It hasn't been made known which Walmart that he was possibly targeting. Blevins has carved out a significant online trail that snakes through some of the darkest corners of the internet, where Nazi death cult propaganda is freely shared. According to Alexander Reed Ross, who tracks violent white nationalists online at the Center for Analysis on the Radical Right, he says Blevins fits a profile of past right-wing mass shooters.
He shares a lot in common with some other profiles of similar kind of fascist terrorist ideologues. People like Devin Arthurs, one of the founders of Adam Waffen Division. And generally what we're talking about when we're looking at these guys is somebody who's sort of alienated and isolated from society at a very young age and seeks radical ideology to form in-group bonds and to kind of overcome their, you know, personal feelings of a failure or antisocial sort of resentment.
According to police records, he was arrested because he was planning to do a mass shooting at a Walmart. And it sounds like that the FBI moved very quickly because it seemed like this was an imminent threat. How does doing a mass shooting at a Walmart, how does that feed into the goals of a Nazi follower like Blevins is being reported to be?
Well, it's a whole format. There's a whole freight of assumptions that are drawn into this this plan. It comes out of a string of mass shooters from Anders Breivik to people he inspired, like the Christchurch shooter, the attempted shooter in Poway, and obviously Patrick Crucius in El Paso. And the idea effectively is kind of mimetic warfare. It's like the spread of fascist memes online and the constant, you know, behavior of psyching each other up to actually commit real life, you know, actions of either like spray painting or assault or even murder in furtherance of the cause is transferred over into, you know, real life actions that, you know, speak louder than words. So mass murder is a sort of a way of conveying the absolute rejection of the modern world, which they believe, the fascists believes to be controlled by Jews, and to reassert sort of the masculinity of, you know, Western man as a dominant paradigm, even if it means death. So the ultimate sacrifice, which then is reintegrated into a kind of martyrdom cult so that someone else down the line can sort of pick up the banner and carry out the same sort of actions.
There is a photograph that law enforcement released of Bevlin's room, or some like a stage that he had put together, I guess, for his online activities. And you see a lot of imagery that seemed to be in conflict. There's the Confederate flag. There's the Nazi flag, and also it seems like what the Saudi Arabian flag. How does all that stuff work for him? He seemed very confused.
Yeah, and I get people asking me, you know, like, is this just some confused guy who's thrown together everything that could possibly oppose, you know, modern liberal democracy? Or is this like a coherent and clearly defined ideology that one might call fascism? And the answer is, it's sort of both. Fascism itself is this sort of syncretic fusion of all of these different kinds of conflicting and combative elements at the furtherance of kind of counter-revolutionary war against liberal modernity. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of conspiracy theories that are involved there in order to make these claims of anti-Semitic claims of elites, you know, Jewish elites running the world.
So they say things like, we hate Muslims, but we like certain kinds of Muslims, the ones who are fighting Jewish control of the world.
Yeah, and specifically the ones who are involved in a martyr cult, right? The one, if you are a staunch believer in, you know, ultimate sacrifice, in extreme violence, and in kind of like the purity of extreme hierarchy and patriarchy, you know, then, you know, you're fine.
All right. So you've been monitoring these people online in their back channels of the internet and their podcasts and their echo chambers. How are things going for them? What seems to be the mood for them, particularly since the loss of Donald Trump and then the reaction to the January 6th insurgency?
Yeah, that's a great question, David. I think there's a nihilistic kind of furor that swept over a lot of the far right after January 6th, when people started to, you know, places like social media site Parler started to erupt in the statement, there's no political solution. And so you saw a lot of people kind of give up on this sort of populist notion that, you know, the far right could bring normal conservatives over through a political movement that would take over the United States. And you started to see more people kind of emerge with this terrorist ideology that they would be able to overthrow the United States through a cascading series of terrorist attacks that would each inspire one another and kind of outdo one another in their horrific consequences.
So how should we view the actions of Coleman Thomas Blevins, who he's a suspect right now? Was he a lone wolf if he had done this attack, or would it have been part of a larger network, a matrix of people who are about to do other attacks like this?
Definitely part of a larger network, that is sort of decentralized and involved in, again, egging each other on to commit violent actions. I think, you know, the federal law enforcement has become, you know, more concerned about this kind of stuff. And so when people fix a time and a place to their threats, that's when they'll swoop in, you know.
So is that something we can draw from what we saw, where we have this guy making these threats online, FBI catches on, and they move really quickly. They contact the Kerr County Sheriff's Office, and they began an investigation, and they see this is not something to toy around with, and they quickly shut it down. This shows that that law enforcement, particularly at the FBI level, they're paying attention.
Right, but at the same time, you know, it's never a good thing to just kind of sort of rest on those laurels of a successful operation here, because the issue is that this is a transnational network with, you know, members abroad in Germany and the UK, and it is an adaptive network that when they start seeing stuff like that happening, they can always change their approach. They can change the words that they use and try to sort of wriggle out from under the thumb of the FBI. So it's always good to stay vigilant there.
Alexander Reed Ross is with the Center for Analysis on the Radical Right. At least three prominent Texas GOP officials took part in the QAnon conference in Dallas last weekend. QAnon is a conspiracy theory movement linked to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. At that event, a former Trump administration official advocated for a military coup to overthrow President Biden. Also at that event were Texas GOP Chairman Alan West, who resigned on Friday, Congressman Louie Gohmert, and Texas Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller. Freelance journalist Stephen Monticelli was able to attend while incognito. You went to the QAnon convention. Is it fair to call it a QAnon convention? What was it?
Yes, I think so. You know, there's been a lot of controversy and debate whether this was in fact a QAnon convention, and local papers here in Dallas, particularly the Dallas Observer, looked into that question. And, you know, I think we have to call it what it is. The organizers go by QAnon John and Q Queen Amy. The QAnon type slogans and references were all over all of the marketing. And there were a number of speakers who explicitly talked about Q. Were there other topics that came up? Yes. But at the end of the day, almost everything that they talked about was related in some way to what you could describe as the QAnon movement.
So why is that so hard to determine, or why are people so cagey about whether or not this is a QAnon event, and why is that important?
I think there's a pattern that a lot of folks have observed, and I saw myself, with regard to how some in the QAnon movement act with regard to directly describing their beliefs, or being pinned down with regard to being affiliated with this movement. I think, you know, there's this pattern of saying one thing to the public and another privately or to their followers. And moreover, why there might be this controversy is that some of the things that, you know, are affiliated with the movement are quite salacious or, absurd even. You know, the notion of a global satanic cabal or a global communist government, or, you know, the harvesting of adrenochrome from the spines of young girls and boys. I think, you know, there's this tendency to try to distance the notion that this is all related to QAnon, because there are high-level elected officials and, you know, the heads of the Texas Republican Party attending this event. And so, you know, I don't know exactly the intention of trying to distance themselves from what they're really discussing. But I think the fact of the matter is that that's what was going on there, and that there are some ostensibly very serious people who have affiliated themselves with this movement and seem, you know, reticent to distance themselves from some of the more, alarming rhetoric.
Okay, so we can establish that these are people that their primary language is dog whistle, and that they are disingenuous in the way that they present themselves to the general public. But once they get behind closed doors, that's when, you know, they can speak more freely. So basically that's what happened at this event, it seems. And the media was not supposed to be there. How did you get in there?
Right. So initially I had applied for a press pass. I had pitched it to a national publication. They didn't want to buy a ticket on my behalf, and they insisted, you know, apply for a press pass. That was pretty much immediately rejected, given my affiliation with some publications that have written about QAnon critically in the past. And so, you know, realizing that I was very likely going to be rejected based on the fact that there had already been some folks that had bought tickets and had those refunded, because they had been critical of QAnon in the past, I had someone locally, a source who was willing to buy the ticket on my behalf. And so they, you know, went and registered for me. They got the ticket so that my name wouldn't have to be on it, and passed it along to me. And, you know, I thought long and hard about this, because there are some ethics that we have to follow when it comes to immersive journalism. And it seemed to me like, you know, the traditional means of collecting this information had been exhausted. You know, I would have preferred to wear a press pass and preferred to identify myself as such. But as a result, you know, that was something that I had to do. And furthermore, I think this was, you know, something of vital public interest, which we later saw when it came to the comments of General Michael Flynn regarding the Myanmar coup and, you know, why at the moment, it seems like he indicated that he thinks it should happen here. And if you look at the forum traffic or the Telegram traffic that happened around and after that, people seemed to, you know, understand what he was saying. The crowd cheered very loudly. And I think it's a demonstration of what we just discussed, that, once it went viral, once it became a part of, the media narrative and folks were discussing what they saw and heard for themselves, he started to try to walk that back. So did Sidney Powell the next day. She actually tried to insist that everybody inside go online and post that did not happen. It was vitally important that we understood what was going on at this event and had some of the, surrounding context for these sorts of comments so that we can better understand, what is the level of sincerity here and, what do they really mean when they say these sorts of things.
Sidney Powell is the attorney. She is licensed in Texas. Her office is in Dallas. She was on stage and she said that Donald Trump could be reinstated.
Right. Right. That was a big theme of a lot of, some of the speakers. They would, suggest that there's this opportunity for, the real president to return, whether it was through the audits that are going on in Arizona and Nevada right now. The voting audits that are going on, they have this belief that those will allow for Donald Trump to be returned as the real president. And, her statements around that just tie into, the longer tail of things that have led up to this event, whether that's January 6th or just the general narratives that you can observe in QAnon forums and QAnon discourse. Something that's worth mentioning is that Andy Meehan was one of the speakers. He asked the crowd, raise your hand, who among you here were in Washington on January 6th? And about a third of the crowd appeared to raise their hand when he asked that. So, when she says, he can be reinstated, whether there's any legitimacy to that or not, it is certainly feeding into and sort of inciting the continuation of these beliefs that is possible.
Right. And you could be in Washington on January 6th and not have been part of the insurgency that stormed the Capitol building. That's a distinction I think that needs to be made. But so the ticket was $500?
Yes, the ticket was $500. The VIP tickets were $1,000.
How many people were there? How many people were willing to shell out that kind of money for what?
Roughly like 300 or so.
They were getting what for this money? It sounds like this is just, you're just getting sort of the kooky part of a fringe movement. You can get that, in some parts of the internet for free.
The main show were these dozens of speakers over 3 days that offered a wide variety of strange narratives and theories that didn't always necessarily tie in together neatly. But all the same seem to, get the crowd really fired up.
So it's one thing to have this hyper-conservative cosplay event, and it's another thing to have elected officials participating. And
yes.
We had that. We had people who were part of the Texas state government, Texas elected leaders there. Also, Alan West, who as of Friday morning, he announced that he is resigning as the Republican Party chair of Texas. Alan West, did you see his speech?
Yeah, I did get to see his speech.
Did he say anything in that speech that was so radioactive that may have forced his resignation?
I don't think anything specific to his speech stood out to me that would have forced that. I think there are a number of things that, may be involved here. The fact that, one, he's decided that he wants to, Flynn endorsed him for governor shortly after Flynn also appeared to endorse a military coup. When it comes to Alan West, I think we have to understand that he has been signaling his open embrace of this movement for quite some time. He used the phrase, "We are the storm," in a large number of official GOP-sponsored events. One in Dallas was called Stop the Steal and featured We Are the Storm on a lot of its marketing. Both of those phrases are things that have been widely embraced by QAnon.
The people who know what to look for can see that there wasn't a whole lot of daylight between Alan West, the Republican Party of Texas, and QAnon.
Correct. I mean, Sid Miller, too, the agricultural commissioner, was there. And he, you know, he seemed to similarly play footsie, so to speak, with this movement, if not openly embrace it.
Stephen Monticelli is a freelance journalist who writes for The Daily Beast and The Dallas Observer and others. He's also the editor of Protean magazine. 100 experts on democracy have signed a new public statement of principles that has a clear and jarring message. If action is not taken to save it, you can kiss our democracy goodbye. Texas is just the latest example of a Republican-controlled state using the lie of significant voter fraud to limit voting and other freedoms that should exist in a legitimate democracy. Johns Hopkins University professor and Washington Post Monkey Cage editor-in-chief Henry Farrell is part of that effort, sounding the alarm. Farrell says the threats to democracy in America are real, and there needs to be national voting standards and a grassroots effort to save the political system.
Well, there are a number of things happening, but one of the most important of those is the loss of belief in elections. And here I think that in particular, the role of the former president, Donald Trump, the way that he refused to accept that he had lost the election, the way that in many ways he still refuses to accept that he has lost the election, and the substantial percentages of Republicans who agree with him, mean that we are really losing faith in how it is that elections actually work. If you look, for example, at what is happening in Arizona, the ways in which that election is being questioned for really what appear to be pretty ludicrous reasons, all of this suggests that we are beginning to lose faith that elections work the way that they're supposed to work. And we're also beginning to lose faith, I think, that when governments lose office, that they're going to vacate office. And that is something which is perhaps the most important part of the definition of democracy. Democracy, as a famous political scientist, Adam Szaborski, put it, democracy is a system where the government can lose elections. And if we find ourselves in a world in which the United States government refuses to accept that it has lost elections, then we suddenly can find ourselves in a world of hurt.
In Texas, we are having a public debate about the future of our elections. Recently, our Democratic representatives in the Texas House of Representatives walked out to bust a quorum to prevent the passage of SB 7, which would have put in a number of new laws and regulations that would have made it harder for people who live in urban areas, particularly people of color, to vote. It would make it much more inconvenient for these people to vote. It's voter suppression. Is that something that we need to be looking at as a danger to democracy?
Yes, it is. Although I have to say that we have seen many, many such barriers being erected over the course of American democracy. Of course, many of them were erected in the pre-civil rights South, and of course, in many parts of the North as well, in order to prevent Black people from voting. But we have also seen a steady undercurrent of efforts by Republicans primarily in recent years, but also sometimes Democrats, to try and rig the system a little bit in their favor, or sometimes more than a little bit in their favor. So I think that when we look at the efforts that the Republicans are involved in places like Texas at the moment, I think that there are three major ways in which their efforts work. One is the kinds of things that you've just discussed, which is making it hard for people to vote, and in particular, making it hard for people who you think are going to vote for the other side to vote. And this is what a lot of the Republican measures are aimed at doing. The second is, of course, gerrymandering districts. And this has become a fine art thanks to statistical techniques, the availability of data and new ways to use that data to try and gerrymander constituencies in such a way that you have a practically guaranteed outcome, so that rather than voters choosing representatives, you have representatives choosing voters. And the final thing, of course, which we saw in the proposed Texan law, which was perhaps one of the most worrying, was a suggestion that it would greatly ease the possibility of declaring that an election had been run fraudulently. That would make it much, much easier to overturn election results and give a lot more discretion to election officials and elected officials to decide when an election needed to be overturned. And that really, I think, is when we begin to see moving from a kind of a situation like a casino, in which the dealer tries to make sure that there is a house edge, to a situation in which if the people in a casino win, suddenly the casino boss decides that the rules are going to change and that they haven't won after all. And I think that is when you really begin to see the corrosion of democracy perhaps develop into something which is worse than that, or at least there is a very real chance that it could work out that way.
But still, we're talking about the end of our democracy in the United States. So we're trying to figure out, what does that mean? I mean, why the warning? What is this warning? We'll still have elections. It's just that some people, it'll be harder for them to vote than others. Does that mean the end of democracy?
That's very hard to say. And I think part of the problem with the language of the end of democracy is that people tend to think about the end of democracy in pretty apocalyptic terms. They think about it as being suddenly you get people in uniforms, shooting everybody who doesn't agree with them and whatever. But if you look at how democracies end, very often they go out not with a bang, but with a whimper. So you could look, for example, at places like Hungary or Poland in Europe, where a democracy has sort of been very badly damaged. Or you could look at Turkey, where you can say that until about 5 or 10 years ago, it was a real democracy. But now very clearly it is a place where if Erdogan, who is the leader of Turkey, if his party loses elections, that he is going to be extremely reluctant to let go. And in those kinds of contexts, life goes on for most people in an authoritarian system. They don't necessarily notice all that much that is different in their day-to-day lives. It's just a gradual sense of things getting more problematic, things getting worse. And so we have, rather than having a sudden dramatic slide into a world in which we have no democracy, we instead are more likely to see a gradual progress with certain key events, which speed things up a little bit, and then things look like they are going to get back a little bit more towards normal, and then they get worse again, and then they get worse again. So that is the trajectory that we need to worry about. And you can think about it a little bit like climate change. You know, so if you can think about that crazy Roland Emmerich movie from about 20 years ago, in which climate change all happens within a period of a day or weeks, and you have all of these waves crashing over the US Capitol and whatever. And this gives a dramatic account, which is what many people think climate change is. But instead, climate change is really, it's a set of ratchet effects in which things get gradually worse in ways that people kind of notice, but also if they have the inclination, they just sort of chalk up to, well, things are bad, but maybe they'll get better again. And in fact, they don't.
Henry Farrell is a Johns Hopkins University Professor of International Affairs and Washington Post Monkey Cage Editor-in-Chief. He joined 100 experts in democracy in signing a letter raising the alarm that American democracy is in danger due to Republican-led efforts to suppress voting and overturn election results. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.